Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast. Conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Really appreciate your support, whether you're watching on YouTube or nightly at 11 on DBNA TV at dbnatelevision.tv or streaming with the DBNA TV app on Amazon Fire, Roku, and Apple TV, or listening on your favorite platform. Before we get to my conversation with Freddie Rivera, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job and then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I could learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. Freddie Rivera is an FM radio DJ and host of the Radio Flyer podcast. He's a SoCal guy I knew from my iHeartRadio days. Used to run into each other as I worked for KFI, and he was producing for JoJo on the radio on Kiss FM, and then he rocked overnights on the legendary station. But his love for radio goes way back.
I was born in LA, but I was pretty much raised in the Inland Empire. Montclair, Ontario, and then I went to high school in Rancho Cucamonga.
When my parents divorced, my dad got a place out in Ontario, and going from Covina to Ontario, it felt like going to another world at that time.
Seriously. When you travel east, outside of Los Angeles, you just feel like you're going further and further away, and it feels like you're in the boondock. It's so funny because when you live over here and you go to L.A., it's like, yeah, a 45-minute drive, no big deal. Yeah, sure, no problem. But if you're in L.A. and you want to come this way, it's like, ah, I'm not doing it. Nah, too far.
We know a lot of people on the west side who have never even traveled east of downtown L.A. They just never have.
West side L.A. people, they don't do downtown L.A. at all. It's too far for them. I don't get the west siders. I love them, but I don't get them.
So you have brothers or sisters, or it's just you?
No, just me. I'm only child.
Same here, man. Same here. How do you feel like that was growing up? Did you feel like you missed out on something? Because I sometimes felt like I could have probably had I certainly would have had a different childhood, but I don't know. I just felt like with all my friends who had siblings, like just some FOMO maybe back in the day.
True, because when I was a kid, I did feel like I was missing out on, you know, having an older brother to learn a couple things from, you know, to toughen you up a little bit. Or because I always felt like, you know, I wasn't enough of this or enough of that as a kid. But it wasn't until I got older, I learned and realized that my weird creativity, you know, and playing with myself and making up my own little world when I was a kid, it really kind of helped me, you know, use that creativity to, you know, my adult life and my career in radio. And that's what helped a lot. And that's what made me kind of strange and weird and, you know, creative all in one. So I don't regret being an only child. I actually love it. It actually worked out for me really well. But when I was a kid, though, yeah, I was pretty, I was a little bit jealous.
Did you put on your own radio shows back when you were a kid?
Yeah. So in high school, I did this online show called Cyber Station 103. And I don't know why I made it.
That's okay. My address after the divorce, the condo was at 105.9. So I was at power 106. I grew up at power 106.
That's hilarious. Yeah, you know, I don't know. There was no 103. I just took it there. But I was a DJ before I got into radio. So I was, you know, doing turntables. I would mix for like my high school. We would do lunches. And I would mix there. Anyway, long story short, I felt like all my friends were becoming DJs and I wanted to kind of up them up a little bit. So I said, how do I take this DJ world, this DJ, you know, gig to the next level? And that's when I first heard, you know, Rick Dees in the Morning on Kiss FM. And when I first heard his show, I'm like, wow, I mean, that guy took it to a whole new level. He's good at what he does. Anyway, long story short, I created like a little home studio. My dad helped me build a little studio in the garage. And, you know, I use whatever microphone I found in a box. And, you know, one of these boom arm things that we have, I think I bought a lamp at Walmart for $20 and I took out the lamp and I just taped the microphone.
No, you didn't. Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, enterprising from the get-go.
Oh yeah, it was, you know, I made it, you know, the best I could, because obviously I couldn't afford anything, you know, really on my, you know, DJ career. But I did the show religiously every Friday night. And I think at the time, you know, online was just beginning to boom. And I was learning a little bit how to create your own website and how to, you know, upload your show to servers. So I literally uploaded my Friday night show, which sounded a lot like a Kiss FM, you know, it was like a 3-hour show. And I would upload it every Friday night, like religiously throughout my whole high school career.
That is so cool. That were you able to track how many people were listening?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, because it showed you a number. And most of the time it was at zero. I mean, it sometimes it was at like 2 or 5. And I knew like my parents were like in the other room.
Yes, I was going to say, if it's single digits, it's family.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Probably one person that stumbled upon it. Who knows what? But yeah, it was, I didn't care. I didn't care about the, you know, the number at the time. It was just, you know, again, I went back to my own little world. I'm in my own little world that I created, and I'm just doing this show and I'm just loving it. And it, you know, over time it started to actually sound pretty decent, I think.
Does it feel like you've gone back there with the podcast?
Yes, big time actually, because, you know, it's weird, Aaron. That's a great question. Because I can't, When I left radio in Dallas and I came back here, I don't know if I wanted to do the whole CyberStation 103 all over again. You know, at my age, being an adult and my experience, am I going to have that passion and drive to do it all over again? And at first I didn't want to. I was like, nah, you know, that's why I started going more for the pilot thing. But the quarantine happened, and when quarantine happened, I knew we would be here for a while. And I'm like, well, you know, we're not going to do much, you know? So I guess I might as well do something like that. And as I started putting the studio together little by little, I think I'll admit I was dragging my feet at first, but when I started putting it together, everything started to come back naturally. And, you know, I bought the soundproofing from and Amazon honestly makes everything a lot easier than, you know, it was back in the day.
Totally.
You know, and everything was a lot, you know, it felt cheaper for some reason this time around. So I bought a little bit of this, bought a little bit of that. And I invited my friend Michelle Zuna to come by and, you know, be my co-host for a podcast. And I got to give credit to my friend Lewis Love, who gave me the name of the podcast, because, you know, I do radio and then I fly. So he said, oh, my gosh, you should be called Radio Flyer.
When I saw that, I was like, of course, this is Freddie's podcast.
Yeah. You know, I said the same thing and I'm like, that's genius, Lewis. And I wish I could have said I thought of it, but I started, you know, little by little putting the studio together, and we started doing a podcast, and Aaron, it was fun again. It was everything became so fun and creative and my own, and it's cool. It's cool to do it.
Yeah. And the reason I ask that is, as you were describing when you were putting, you know, CyberStation 103 together, and the idea where you weren't necessarily doing it for the clicks, for the listens, it was just a passion project. It's
right.
Similar to how I feel about this podcast and how I figured you probably felt about yours. Cause we're not getting into it, making this huge splash. Like, okay, I've got 13 advertisers to get through before we get to the interview, before we get to the conversation. It's like, no, right. I'm cracking open the mic. Going to have some fun with friends.
It's cool because, you know, you don't have to worry about, you know, the money part of it, the business side of it. Which honestly, I was, you know, always pretty terrible, you know, at the monetizing part of everything. But, you know, you learn as you get older. But it's back to the creative process again. And it's like a reminder of why we got into radio and broadcasting. You know, doing this, it I can go any which way with it. You know, I want to. And now that, you know, I'm a little bit older, you know, I've taken it out outside of music and started, you know, diving into other people's radio career and asking them how they got their start. And it's kind of given me practice to become a better interviewer, because honestly, my whole career, I've been a terrible listener. So
seriously, so, really? You feel like that's.
Yeah. So I think now I'm starting to really get the experience of becoming a better listener and, you know, taking the spotlight and moving it over to the, you know, whoever I'm talking to, because, you know, it's like Anthony Bourdain's show on, you know, CNN. It started out being about food and about him traveling. But eventually the spotlight ended up being on whoever's story he was talking to on the show. And yeah, it was, you know, they were eating while they were talking about, you know, whatever they were talking about. That was like you know, the setting, but the real story, the real juice was the person's story that they were sharing on his show. And I thought that's gold right now, you know?
Yeah. I think when you can set aside the idea that you've got somebody there for an interview and it's really just a conversation that happens to be recorded, that's when you find it. That's when you feel like it, yep. that box has been checked.
Yep. Exactly.
Your studio setup, I notice obviously a professional microphone there. What's the microphone you're using? And I bring that up for a reason. So what's the mic you're using?
So this is the Electrovoice RE20. So to be honest with you, besides the computer here in the studio, Aaron, I thought, you know what? Okay, so I already have the mixer here. And, you know, I had the monitor. And I had these cables from, I don't know when, years ago. But I thought I might as well, if there's going to be one thing I can splurge on, it's going to be a brand new RE20. So I bought this online and brand new. And I bought a little, mic processor to go with it.
Yeah.
But when in that little package, you know, yeah, you open it up and it's in that black foam and a zipper, man, I got to tell you, this is, you know, because we've been working, you know, we've been working hard. It was like a reward. I was like, this is cool. So yeah,
exactly. The reason I bring that up is I also, you know, I've got the mixer. Okay. I splurged a little bit on that. And I was using a lav mic for quite some time. I was using a different Shure mic that was more for instruments because at the time that I was needing a microphone, that's what I could afford. And
right.
To be honest, until I bought this one, and this is the SM7B, until I got this one, plugged it in, and tested it for the first time, I did not feel like it was a professional podcast yet. I didn't feel like I was back in the studio. I just felt like I was playing around.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing that you probably felt that same way until you got that microphone, plugged it in, sat down, and you're like, oh shit, I'm back.
Yeah. Because I mean, you know, I've had the mixer before and I've had the keyboard and I thought, okay, cool. It'd be cool to do a little podcast. But at the end of the day, you know, I feel like where I was in my career and in my experience, if there is one thing that I could feel professional with is the microphone, because, you know, everything else, you know, is kind of interchangeable. But I mean, the microphone, if you have a solid mic, you can go so far with that. And I thought, if I need to do a voiceover for this, or if I need to, you know, track for a random show here, or just continue doing my podcast, as long as you have a good microphone, good quality microphone, you can go so far with it and have it for such a long time.
Totally. Yeah. No, I'm right there with you. Let's go back. I want to hear some of the CyberStation 103. I'm sure you have it queued up. Let's hear it. No. Do you have any of that like is on a drive and you know exactly where it is?
Yeah, I do know exactly where it is. It's on the little plastic cassette tapes, you know?
Oh, brilliant. That, yes.
I had a tape deck and I would record them on tape. That's how long ago it was. And I have a bunch of tapes with them on it. And, if I were to play it back, I sound a little weird, Aaron. I sound like, you know, it's like my voice is a little not mature. It's a little embarrassing, to be honest with you. But you know what? You could tell the kid was having fun, you know, like, you know, I was having a good time doing it for sure. But you know what? Eventually, every week, like I was doing it religiously and I was listening back to myself. Because I think I was working at Kiss FM at the time as a phone op, and I was living in Rancho, so I had a 45-minute drive. If I phoned up on the weekend, get up in the morning and drive, you know, down the 210 to Burbank, I had a 45-minute, you know, drive to listen to myself. So I would listen to my own show, and I would critique myself and make myself better. And I would listen to the radio here in LA, and I would try to sound more like them each time. And eventually, I got okay, you know. So
you brought up Rick Dees as one of your inspirations, and CyberStation 103 sounded a lot like Kiss FM. You eventually interned for Rick Dees. What was that first day like?
Well, okay. So that first day, I actually snuck in the building. So we were across the street at the Warner Brothers building at the time. It was the brown one on the 8th floor. And I was there once a few months back for a tour. Real quick backstory, I went down to try to become an intern with Rick Dees, or at least get a photo with him, at a Krispy Kreme Donuts. They were doing a live remote in Burbank at a Krispy Kreme Donuts. They had the big rig, the 18-wheeler.
Yep.
And I met Rick Dees, and he was so kind and so nice. Took a picture with him. And then I met a guy named producer Ruben, who was also one of his assistant producers. And I went up to him and I said, hey, you know, what does it take to become an intern for you guys or to, you know, to get hired? He says, oh, you know, we're not really hiring interns, but come for a tour. So that's how the tour happened. So finally I decided, well, you know what? I still haven't been hired as an intern, and I've been trying and I've been applying. Let me go to apply in person. Let me put on a suit. So I did. It was like right after I graduated, I put on a suit and tie, and I drove my blue Chevy Silverado at the time on the 210 freeway to the building. And I got there like around 7:30 in the morning. It was really early. And I was sitting there for a while, and I'm like, well, maybe I could just show up in the lobby and it'll look good if I'm sitting there so early. So I said, all right, let me try to go in early. You know, let me see if they'll let me in. And I'm walking in, and there's this lady walking in front of me, and she lets me in right behind her. And as we get to the elevator, you need a key card to, you know, go up to your floor.
Right.
And I lied and I said, oh, I forgot my key card. She's like, oh no, don't worry. What floor are you on? And I'm like, oh, 8, please. You know, I'm gonna. I don't know why I did that. It was crazy. Anyway, the elevator doors open up, and you know, when you're in an office or a station that early in the morning, you could smell the fresh brewing coffee. You can smell people's perfume and cologne, and it's like, it's so early. I walk in the lobby and it's dark, and the double doors to the lobby are closed. So I knew where the restroom was because I've been there before for the tour. So I go in the restroom, and I'm pacing back and forth probably like 20 minutes. And I'm like, all right, should I go? Should I stay? I don't know. So I decided finally, literally after 20 minutes, I walk outside of the restroom and I decide, all right, let me go back to my truck. I walk out and I turn left to go to the elevators. Guess who I run into? Ruben, producer Ruben
That's
Rodriguez.
So good.
And he's holding this stack of newspapers and magazines for show prep, I guess. And he goes, oh my God, what are you doing here, Freddie? And I said, oh, I came to apply. Some lady let me in. He's oh, all right. Well, hold these newspapers for me. Follow me inside. Long story short, that became my first day as an intern. And so I became an intern for Rick Dees at 18 years old. And that was so cool because that first day, I think Paulina Rubio and I don't know who else was there, but it was Paulina Rubio and somebody else. And I saw two celebrities that morning. And I'm an 18-year-old kid at a rancho. My mind is just blown. Insane.
You're wearing your suit. You're probably the only one on the air wearing a suit. You're all dressed up to the nines. They're like, who's this kid?
Who's this kid? Why is he here? You know, I definitely didn't look like I belonged, you know, for sure. But it was an experience. And then I think I called my mom. I was like, the show ended at 10. And I'm like, Mom, guess what? I'm an intern for Rick Dees. That was so cool. And that was my first day as an intern. I don't remember too much about it, but I remember like my first actual duty or job was I had to listen to Rick Dees live. And whenever he mentioned like an advertiser, I would have to do air checks.
Right.
I would record, and instead of giving it to the client, I would just give it to producer Ruben and he would give it to the client. But I would do air checks for Rick Dees.
That is cool. That is cool. Yeah. And how long until you ended up doing phones at KISS? And were you doing phones at KISS before or after you hooked up with KGGI out in the Inland Empire? Like what's the timeline there?
So I started as an intern for Dees, and I was there for about 6 to 8 months. Obviously too long to be an intern. You know?
With no college credit, right?
No college credit. No, because I was going to college for part-time. So, you know, I guess at the time it was kind of under the table. I don't know how they made it work, but I was lucky enough to be there. There was a guy named Alex Cortez, who he saw that I was just obsessed with being there, you know, for free. And he's like, look, let's offer this kid one day a phone op. So they asked me to come in on Saturday mornings at 10 to phone op for Gary Spears at the time and a couple other jocks who were there on the weekend. And I started being their phone op, and I was there for about a year, year and a half. And then from there, I got asked to be a board op for, at the time it was Hot 92.3. Ron Shapiro gave me a shot to be the board operator there. And that was really cool. And I was board opping and phone opping for KISS on the weekends for about a year, maybe 2 years. And eventually there was a guy named ODM who was doing late nights on KISS FM at the time. And I knew 99.1 because I'm from the IE. And so I said, hey, ODM, I have this air check, but it's just from like my internet radio station called Cyber Station 103. Would you mind giving it to Jesse Duran, who was a program director at KGGI at the time? And he goes, no, not a problem, man. Yeah, for sure. He was really cool about it. He bridged the gap between me and Jesse. And long story short, it was because of that, I got my job as a part-time, they hired me as a board op first, but eventually a part-time on-air DJ at 99.1 KGGI.
It, overnights, right? Midnight to 2 or something like that?
Yeah, it was like Sundays, midnight to like 2 a.m. is when it started. And then eventually it became like, you know, a weekend shift here and there. And then it became, you know, the fill-in guy. So then I would, you know, once I got good enough, I was able to fill in for everybody. So that was cool.
And how long were you at KGGI before Kiss FM came calling? Because when I would run into you in the building, you were hanging out with JoJo a lot in the evenings. And then all of a sudden, here's Freddie overnights.
I felt like I was like the longest part-time DJ in the world, Aaron. At 91 KGGI, part-time for 7 years. 7 years. And I guess it didn't seem that long when I was there because I was enjoying myself and I was still young. But it became a little embarrassing when I had a Verizon phone bill and I couldn't afford it sometimes. And my parents would be like, all right, Freddie, look, it's great that you're on the radio, but we need you to get a real job. And I said, no. So I called my friend Victor. He got me a job at Subway. And I worked there for 2 weeks and I hated it and I quit. And then I became like a telemarketer and that was awful and I quit.
Oh God, I think I'd rather go back to Subway.
Oh my God. Let's see, what else did I do? I sold Cutco cutlery. You know,
I love the Cutcos.
Door to door. I did everything. I did it all. And, you know, eventually, I think it was 7 years later, Clear Channel became iHeart. And that's when they did a huge transition within the company. And, you know, they let go of a lot of people. One of them was Jesse Duran, the program director. So because I went to do an interview for a full-time gig during the time I was part-time at GGI, it was in Fresno. And I met a guy named Tony Banks, who still works for iHeart. They turned me down for that gig, but they still liked me enough to ask me to fill in interim for Jesse Duran. And long story short, they made me the full-time night guy after they did all the changes, and I became the full-time 7 to midnight, you know, Monday through Friday guy on 99.1 after 7 years.
Radio cuts are so weird because if you're left behind, and I know recently, you know, like Sinclair Broadcast Group just had a bunch of layoffs in their TV stations nationwide, and I talked with some people that I know in those newsrooms, and when you're not in those cuts, it's such a bittersweet feeling because you've just watched, you know, in your case, your mentor lose his job, friends and people who feel like family lose their jobs, and then you're looking around and you're like, man, I'm grateful to be here, but I'm sad that it's not with people I've grown to love.
Yeah, you know, I had the privilege of talking to Jesse Duran about this recently too, and we were talking about how, you know, being in radio long enough, you know, sometimes you can be on both ends of that spectrum, and you know, it's bittersweet, like you said, because, you know, if you get a promotion because of somebody else who got fired, you know, it's like, it's great you got a promotion, but you hate the fact that you got it that way, you know, and it's a lot more than often it ends up being that way. But, you know, that's the nature of the business that we're in, you know, and, you know, most of us know that. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we don't get to experience that, you know, too often.
Right. It also depends on how, like, the management handles things. Like I've been there, not here in LA, but another market where there were cuts. And after the morning cuts were done, the general manager came in and was like, huh, guys, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
You're the A team. You're the A team. And we're looking around going, we know the A team. They just got fired. They just got laid off. So it also depends on how things are handled top down.
Absolutely.
So take me then. We've talked about KGGI. You're doing nights. Everything's cool. Take me to that first night you're actually on the air at Kiss, having grown up listening to Kiss, you know, sneaking into buildings just to be an intern for Rick Dees. Take me to that first week that you're on the air at Kiss.
Okay, so it started actually at 99.1 because, you know, 99 was very rhythmic and hip hop and urban. And I felt like I was never going to be urban enough and cool enough and hip hop enough, you know, and I loved hip hop music. It's just, I just didn't talk that way. I wasn't cool enough, Aaron. But
you weren't the hip hop head necessary to carry that. Right.
So to be different but to still be good, you know, I crafted my sound to sound more like a Kiss jock on 99.1. And it worked because, you know, it had a good sound, but it was a different sound. So it was a good balance. And because of that, I would still listen to Kiss and shape myself to sound a lot like them. Just to get better, just because I was obsessed with, you know, critiquing myself all the time. And so I would also, in addition to being on 99.1, I would send my air checks over to John Ivy every now and then. And I would hear nothing ever. And so it would go week to week to week to month. And I would shop my air check around. Obviously, John Ivy would be one of them still. And I think it was like a year into being the night guy at KGGI, and I was doing really well. And I felt like I finally, for the first time in my life, got a full-time radio gig. And I'm finally gaining my confidence, and I'm finally gaining my own unique sound. It was almost a year into my first full-time gig at KGGI. John Ivy, Lisa Marie calls me on the phone and says, "Hey, I got John Ivy. He's gonna get you on the phone in about 30 seconds. Want to make sure you're available?" And I said, "Yeah."
You're always available when John Ivy calls.
Always available. So they connect him over, and he that phone call, he basically asked me, he said, "Hey, backstory, long story, quick story. I had a late night dinner with JoJo on the radio because I was doing. I'm sorry, I jumped ahead. Okay, let me go back. So he called me and said, "Hey, let's have a lunch. I hear you're doing great in GGI. I'm listening to your air checks and this and that. I want to bring you to lunch and, talk about, you know, some opportunities over here at Kiss as well." And I thought, oh my gosh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
We went to, what was it? What's that restaurant across the street from that Warner Brothers building? I forgot what it's called. Anyway, we went across.
Claim Jumpers?
Yes.
It was Claim Jumpers. Okay.
Yeah. I met him at the iHeart building, but we walked across the street to Claim Jumper. And I guess he just wanted to get a feel for me to make sure that I wasn't like a complete like douchebag or something. And the lunch went really well. I was super nervous, obviously, you know, it's John Ivy. And they hired me to become a weekender at Kiss. And I'd go in once or maybe twice a week. And I'd be the weekend guy at Kiss and full-time at KGGI. My world was perfect. It was perfect.
I mean, mind blown right there.
But that lasted for about 6 months. So that 6 months was like bliss. It was like I was on top of the world, on top. But then everything changed 6 months later because John Ivy calls me on a Friday night after I'm doing my night gig at GGI. And he goes, "So I got a weird thing I want to ask you and offer you." And he says, "You know, and I'm going to give you the weekend to think about it, you know, because I know you're doing great at KGGI and I know you're a jock and you're coming up and you're doing this. But what would you think if you became JoJo's producer, doing some overnights for us, but also still on the radio on the weekend, you know, and then you can still probably do KGGI if you want. Yeah. And it's a little weird, you know, you're going to be, you know, working for another jock, but I'll give you the weekend to think about it. Let's talk Monday or Tuesday. Okay. And I said, "Well, John, you can give me the weekend to think about it, you know, but yes, absolutely." And he loved that. And he goes, "Okay, well, we'll talk next week." And I said, "All right, cool." And then that eventually led to me transferring to Kiss, becoming full-time as JoJo's producer, and then doing weekends as well, live on Kiss. So that was like, you know, it's kind of all over the place, but it was cool.
No, and radio's like that all over the place, you know? You benefited, I think, from the idea that, you know, I think a lot of people, when they try to get to a major market, they do so from out of state. They do so from across the country. You know, the idea of, okay, let's see if I can up and move here. But here, I mean, it was almost like a feeder station, a feeder system. You know, TV talks a lot about Bakersfield and Fresno and Sacramento. Yes. Into LA. Here, mm-hmm. You know, Riverside, Palm Springs, that area, San Diego, it feeds yep. right into LA, and it great opportunity for you.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, we're from the same business, so obviously we know how lucky it is we are to, you know, and most people, you know, come from a small town in Wisconsin or, you know, Nebraska, and, you know, come out and they work their way to, you know, the major market. And I was lucky enough to, you know, be born here, raised here, and be on the stations. And, you know, this is my little community world because I went to high school out here, but, you know, I built a little audience in Riverside with GGI. And now that I'm going to KISS, I'm able to, you know, take some of them with me because, you know, LA and Riverside, they bleed into each other. So that was, it was cool. I mean, it was, you know, I really thought I was the luckiest person in the world, you know, to do that.
Now, you brought up the idea that to work in LA, most of the time you have to leave LA, leave Southern California, get your experience, come on back. You kind of did it the opposite, where you never really left Southern California. You got the experience in Southern California, but then you still left going to Dallas. How did that come about?
Okay, so at first, I think I was being shaped to be one of the full-timers on KISS Monday through Friday. But what happened was, I think the whole chain of command, Ryan Seacrest was doing mornings, and then JoJo, I wanted to move, but I think there was no movement happening. You know, everybody was very, very secure, and everything was working really well. It was a well-oiled machine, so there wasn't going to be many changes happening. So there's nowhere for me to go. And I think John Ivey thought that I hit a ceiling, or saw that I hit a ceiling at KISS, because, you know, I'm tracking overnights. I'm doing the overnights, you know, Monday through Friday, and I'm doing the weekends, and I'm doing KGGI. But I think I hit a ceiling to, you know, where do I go now? You know, where does Freddie become, you know, his own person, you know, and grow from there, I guess. And eventually he out of nowhere, I get a call saying, so the first meeting was weird because he calls me into his office and he goes, so Freddie, I got some news for you. You know, we're doing some budget cuts and, you know, you're not really producing for JoJo anymore. You know, you're kind of doing your own thing and this and that. And I could see that you're a little frustrated and you've hit a ceiling. You know, I really don't know what to do with you. So I don't know what's going to happen to you here at KISS. And
it's such a weird.
I'm like, all right. And, you know, it was weird because it was just like everything was going 100 miles an hour and it just hit a wall. And he's like, let's talk in a week because I'm trying to think of some ideas on what to do with you. I'm like, all right. And then so, you know, that week was, you know, psychologically, you know, just torture.
I almost would rather he not call me and then just in a week with that phone call telling me what he thought about over the last week. Don't give me a week to think about it.
There is a reason for everything that John Ivey does. There is a reason behind it, you know, and a week later, great news, Freddie, I got something for you. And this is going to be a great gig and I'm so happy for you. He says, you're going to be the afternoons live and you'll also be the music director or the, you know, the APD, the assistant program director. And I go, oh my gosh. Okay. Where? He goes, Dallas. And at first I'm like, okay, you know, Dallas wasn't even on my radar. I was already doing tracking for KISS in Dallas.
Okay.
So I knew people there and they were always so nice to me. Shout out to Patrick Davis, you know, great PD out there. And it was great. But for me to have lived my entire life and, you know, been lucky enough to do that, I'm in my 30s. And then he goes, hey, guess what? Got you something. You're going to Dallas. You're leaving in about a month. You know, good luck. And my whole world just flipped upside down. And it was exciting because, you know, he locked me in a great gig. And it really was a step up from what I was doing at KISS. But to me at that time, it was not a step up. You know, to me, it was, well, I built this audience and my family's here. My whole world is here. So I'm going to leave everybody here and build something new in Dallas. And that's, you know, I guess I should have known this was coming because I've never done it before. So to be honest, I didn't want to do it. I really did not want to do it. And I called my best friend. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in a pickle. what do I do? You know? And he's like, Freddie, don't go. You're not going to be happy. This and this and that. And I was going back and forth and everybody was telling me, Freddie, I mean, well, some people were telling me, don't go. You know, people in the profession were telling me, Freddie, go. What are you going to do here at KISS? You can't just be the, you know, overnight guy forever or, you know, whatever. And I said, I know this is the right thing to do. I know how this business works. And if I tell John Ivy no, it'll also make him upset. And I said, you know, I got to do the right thing. It's time to grow up. So I said, I told John Ivy, yes, I'm in, I'm going to do it. And everything, the transition happened so fast. I mean, so fast, within a blink of an eye, I'm moving everything into my new, and it's a nice apartment too, to be honest with you. It's really nice. Right next to the Galleria off the toll road in Dallas. I'm moving into Dallas. And I mean, Aaron, it was like a blink, man. It was like my world was perfect. And I was on top of the world and knew everybody at every restaurant and every place. And I had my places to go to. And now I'm in this, you know, strange land, you know, a strange, you know, streets and stores and accents. And it was weird. I mean, I had family in Texas, but they're in Austin, which is like a 3.5 hour drive. It was just weird for me. And I think because it was, everything happened so fast and it wasn't my decision to move to Texas, it was hard on me psychologically. I felt like, you know, the gig was great and they treated me well, but I think me not wanting to be there on my own showed in my performance or my attitude.
Yeah.
So me and the program director didn't really become in sync with each other. And because of that, we both decided, well, I have a great reputation with iHeart. I've been here for 15 years. I don't want to ruin it. I don't want to get fired. And and he wants somebody who really wants to be there and wants to be gung-ho about it and, you know, is 100% all the way in. And for me, it's just, I feel like, you know, half of my soul is still in LA, but I'm here because I feel like I'm daydreaming and I'm walking, you know, I'm performing the action, but my mind and my body and my mind and my soul is still over there. And so I decided, you know, before I get fired, before anything, you know, bad happens, this is about maybe like 9, 10 months, maybe 11 months. It was 11 months in. We had a talk, you know, over a course of time, you know, where, you know, things were a little bit iffy already. And I said, you know, what's the best thing for me, you know, to get fired or to walk away? And, you know, and he said, you know, he said, you should walk away. You know, it looks better if you walk away. You know, granted, was that the best thing to do? You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe getting fired, I could have got a severance package. But, you know, I called John Ivy on the phone and I think he was just beyond upset at the fact that I didn't make it work. And you know, rightfully so, he was beyond upset because I made him look bad, you know, because he helped me get the job.
Right.
And I mean,
you're his handpicked guy to go there. Yeah.
And I'm sure the guy over there had his pick, you know, but John Ivy, you know, really stuck his neck out for me to get the job. And, you know, and honestly, you know, I was still inexperienced and young and, you know, I felt like a scared little boy, you know, and I did what I thought was the right thing. I felt like my heart wasn't in it. And for the first time ever, I was confused. So I thought I did what I thought was right. And we both shook hands and agreed, just walk away from this. You don't have to pay back moving expenses, you know, but this is going to be it for you. You know, if there's anything we need to help you find a job, you know, be more than happy to help you. So I walked away. And then after that, I walked away happy because I felt in my heart I was doing the right thing. But then once I came back to California, it hit me. Then I was just completely out of a career, out of a job, out of a career, nothing, silent. And I think because I did it the way I did it, I think I pissed off a lot of people more than I thought. Because for me, in my head, I'm like, okay, the best way to do it is be cool, shake hands, walk away from it, being in Troy, you're good. But the damage was already done. So for me to bounce back so quickly wasn't going to happen. You know, I had to pave the road myself. I had to find myself my next radio gig. And most likely it wasn't going to be iHeart, at least for the first, you know, comeback. So I had to really I took like a two, it was like almost a 2 year break, Aaron, a 2 year break, 1 year, because, you know, I was still finding my ground. And I think, you know, it wasn't Freddie's depressed and I'm crying myself to sleep. It was never like that. But I think for me, it was more so I was a deer in headlights, you know, like, what just happened in the last year and a half? Like,
Or not even the deer in headlights, but the deer who just got hit by the car with those headlights. And you're over on the side of the road licking your wounds, not sure how to get back up.
Everything happened so fast. And I was on the floor for about a year. You know, I wish I got up faster, but, you know, everything was so perfect before. And for it to tumble down that fast, you know, I was a deer in the headlights for a year. And then I started to pick up. And I got offers. I got offers in a lot of great markets. You know, Vegas was one of them. And, you know, everything was looking great. And then the pandemic hit. And when the pandemic hit, I almost got a gig in Las Vegas. And it was back at iHeart. Everything was looking good. But they lost the budget and they couldn't hire me because, you know, the pandemic hit.
Right.
So I had to stay out another year. But eventually, the good news is I ended up still with a radio gig that I'm working at now. But yeah, that was that's kind of how it played out and how of Dallas.
And what's the gig now?
So now I'm back on the air and I'm doing weekends at Cola 99.9 with Jesse Duran, who was the program director who first put me on the radio back in the day. And it's really cool. It's great to be back on the radio. And they play like 80s and 90s. And some of those songs have like a 28 to 30 second intro, which, you know, if you're from the top 40, I'm not used to that. So like, this is cool. So man, I got to tell you, you know, just being back even just once a week, Aaron, is honestly the greatest feeling in the world. And it's given me the confidence and I feel excited. And I'm talking to people again in iHeart, outside of iHeart, everywhere. And, you know, I do feel like I'm back up and running and the train is going again. You know, it's starting to pick up speed. But man, those 2 years was long. It was long, Aaron.
Prior to feeling like you got punched in the gut and kind of left on the side of the road and trying to figure out how to walk, career or life, had there ever been anything comparable to that that just knocked you down to where you really kind of staggered and stumbled to get back up?
No, this was the absolute worst thing in my life. I mean, only because, you know, I mean, there's been deaths in the family, of course, and that's always very hard, you know, but this was so, you know, I felt like all of it was me and I messed up, you know, and I, you know, we love we are passionate about the career. And I think that's what makes us so, you know, addicted to it, that, you know, I built my entire life and persona and identity and my whole world around my career for so long. So when all of that was gone, you know, it's like almost like, oh my gosh, who am I and where do I begin? You know, and now that we're also in the social media world, you know, I didn't have a publicist. So I'm like, do I announce that I left? Do I not announce that? No, that I'm not working anymore. It's kind of embarrassing, but you know, you live and you learn and you realize people just don't care about you that much. You know, and it was a good feeling for me to know that I could stay under the radar, gather my things, work on my life, and then come back to it as I am now. So, but yeah, it was very hard. But I think the lessons I learned are invaluable. And I think, you know, at my age, you know, I feel like a lot of people learn these lessons early in their age, you know. And I guess I've been lucky or in a bubble in my whole life, and you know, the bubble bursted, but it was a pretty big burst, and I've learned a lot.
So where does flying come in? Because you mentioned in the very early part of our conversation, your new podcast is called Radio Flyer. Obviously, we've gone over the radio side of things. Where does piloting come in? Because I'd be watching your social media in recent years, and it's like, boom, Freddie's flying a plane. OMG. Where did that come in?
Quick story, my dad worked for Boeing my whole life, so we would go to air shows as a kid, you know, and I always had a fascination and passion for airplanes too, in aviation. But, you know, growing up and you know, barely going to college, and, you know, I felt like I was never smart enough to be a pilot, you know, and or, you know, rich enough, because it's a lot of money to become a pilot, you know. And but when I was working at KISS, that gave me the opportunity to A, afford to go to flight school. But more so, it was more so than the money, it gave me the confidence I was extremely confident with myself because I'm working at KISS and I'm on air at KGGI and I'm doing it. And I just felt very confident. And I think me and JoJo were down at Morton's having a tea one night. And I was showing him this flight simulator. And he goes, "Freddie, you're really passionate about flying. You ever thought about, you know, taking flying lessons?" Like, "Oh, I thought about it. You know, I just, you know, I don't know." And he's like, "Well, this is the perfect time. You know, maybe you can afford it. Maybe you can go do it." And, you know, I thought, man, maybe I should, you know. And I called up the local airports and I said, "Hey, you know, what does it take to, you know, get behind and do a discovery flight?" And they invited me to Van Nuys and I did a discovery flight. And Aaron, it takes one flight, one flight to get bitten by the bug, you know, to realize, oh my gosh, this is it. You know, you can totally do this, you know. And the way they sold it to me, and it's true. It's like, you know, anybody can pretty much fly the plane. You know, you get behind, you know, as long as you're not, you know, frightened, you can get behind the plane and it's pretty, you know, easy to, you know, take the yoke and fly your plane for a little bit, you know? And I thought, oh my gosh, this is cool. Yes, I can do it. And they give me the rundown of the pricing and everything. So I enrolled at Corsair Aviation in Van Nuys. And I started doing it and I started progressing. I did my first solo, my second solo, my first cross country. I think where they get you though is, you know, they put you in the plane right away and you're flying, but then they hit you with, well, you also have to study and you got to do all this groundwork and take the written test and study for your check ride. And studying for your private pilot's license is to me like the bar exam. It's unbelievable how much knowledge you need. I mean, it's one thing to understand avionics and the science and, you know, how a stall occurs and you know, what kind of fuel you got to use. But then it's another of learning the regulations. What are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do? You know, and you know, how often do you have to do it per, you know, the regulations per the FAA? You gotta know all of it just for flying a tiny little plane for fun. So I can imagine what it's like to do commercial, but still it's worth it. It's 100% worth it. And I think, man, it's the best feeling in the world.
How many hours did you end up logging and how close are you to possibly getting your private pilot's license if you decide, okay, I'm going to go back full bore?
Yeah. So I'm super close. So where I left off, and this was just probably about 2 weeks ago, I have one more cross country solo to do. So that's basically, you know, flying from Van Nuys to Santa Maria and back. And then the check ride. So I have technically just one required flight and the test, and that's it. So that's how close I am. So it's not a matter of, you know, being able to afford at this point. It's just a matter of studying the material because you got to pay like $1,000 for the test. And I want to make sure that I'm 100% ready to do the test. So that's where I'm at, but I'm super close. And
you talked about the mental health in Dallas. Obviously it took a hit. You didn't necessarily want to be there, or at least it wasn't on your terms. And then obviously the mental health in the year that you got back before the pandemic, and we could talk mental health during the pandemic all day. How is it now? And how do you feel like the last 2 to 3 years has shaped you, has left you?
So I think my progression from 99.1 KGGI to KISS happened almost too perfectly. It was just like, I mean, granted, I was at GGI for a long time, but it was like everything was so fast and skyrocketed. I mean, I was all of a sudden I became full-time at GGI. A year later, I'm doing weekends on KISS. Less than a year later, I'm full-time on KISS and on KGGI and I'm George's producer. And it was just within a span of 2, 3, 4 years, everything just blew up. And, you know, it gives you a huge sense of confidence and, you know, it makes you feel good. I was walking on the moon. But, you know, to be honest, you know, the reality finally sets in afterwards when, you know, you realize that, you know, all that can be gone and lost. But for me, I think it was, you know, it teaches you a lot about not just the career, but about life. And I think, you know, appreciation and the maturity of the level I'm at now versus, you know, where I was just a year and a half ago, you know, and and learning that, you know, your identity should not be wrapped in your career, but your identity should be who you are, you know, and that could be your own brand. And you take that with you to your career. And, you know, networking with everybody, appreciating every part of the career. And, you know, it's taking me to another level. You know, I know I'm a different person than I was a year and a half ago. I can't tell you what kind of person I am, you know, but, but, you know, in life, you know, you transition into somebody new, and I find myself, you know, doing things differently, you know, for sure. And living my life a little bit differently. And ultimately, honestly, I see things differently, completely differently now. And, you know, there's a change happening, currently happening still. I don't know what it is, but it's a change for sure.
But you feel it.
It's a change, and it's a change for the better. 100%. Absolutely. You know, I still feel very confident, and, you know, I still love, passionate about radio and broadcasting and storytelling. It's just, I'm a little bit of a different person now, and I'm thankful for that, because, you know, we hit a ceiling with ourselves, you know, and, you know, you could be this one way, and then you reach that point where you get frustrated with life sometimes, you know, and you feel like you're stuck. I don't feel that way anymore. I don't feel stuck. I feel more free. I feel more like anything is possible. I can go in any direction. I got a home studio now, you know, and it's gotten exciting again. I'm excited again. So that's where I'm at.
When you were working those 7 years part-time at GGI, your parents would be like, "Hey buddy, you don't necessarily have to give up the dream, but you do have to work some more at something else." You were talking about Subway and telemarketing and Cutco. The last couple of years, you didn't even have the part-time at GGI. How were the parents with everything?
The last couple of years? I had, you know, side gigs every here and there, and would track for, you know, random stations and shows and stuff like that. But, you know, because of the pandemic hit, you know, everybody was kind of home. So it was, I'll be honest, when the pandemic hit, for me, life didn't get worse. It actually got more exciting, just because, you know, because I was just, you know, that first year before that, I was just like stuck, like I said. But when the pandemic hit, it hit everybody. So I felt like, all right, now everybody has something else to deal with. And I hope nobody's focusing on the fact that I just lost in life. And then now we're all in this together. And I feel like we have something collectively that we can focus on, you know, and work on, you know, and honestly, it was a blessing to have been home with my dad, spending time with the family, seeing my mom, and slowing down in life and appreciating the little things, because, I'm telling you, the growth process, you can't learn this stuff in school, or somebody, you know, can't tell you, Aaron, you know, you're going to be this way one day, this is why, and this is why you should do this and do that. Life has to just hit you, and that's when it helps you see things differently and become a different person.
And also, you went into the pandemic, I feel like, with a little more confidence, because Vegas wanted you but couldn't hire you because of budgetary reasons, not because you were you.
Right, exactly. And it gave me hope, because I had a couple offers and a couple really good ones too. So it was bittersweet, because I was confident that, all right, cool, I'm still of value. That's great. So, you know, I could bounce back from this. At the same time, though, I had to sit a whole year out, and I'm like, oh my gosh, how long is this going to last? Because I was so close to working again. And, you know, if you've been out, been working your whole life since you were a kid, and you're finally not working every day, that could really, like, you know, mess with your mind. So the 2 years was, you know, I'll tell you what I've learned. I am so much more patient now at this point in my life than I was just even a year ago. You know, I've learned patience. I've learned, you know, you've seen that movie Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee. You know, I don't know, this is one part where, like, he goes into this cave, and they shut the doors on him, and he just doesn't sit there. He was fighting all these people, but then he sits there and he crosses his legs and he meditates. You know, he's about to die. He's about to die, but he just meditates anyway, because what else is he going to do with his time? You know, I felt like, you know, what else am I going to do with my time? You know, like, I can't go work for anybody right now. Nobody's hiring. You know, I've been out for a year. I think it's time to just slow down and focus on what you do have. Play with the cards that you are currently dealt with, and appreciate what you do have, because, you know, when life gets fast and your career gets busy, you forget that the roof over your head is the biggest thing to be grateful for. You know, if you have your parents, big thing to be grateful for. If you have somebody that loves you, if you have any kind of family or great friend that loves you, a friendship you've had since you were a kid, or you know, even a car to drive you in Southern California. Those are the things that I became really grateful for. And it sounds cliche, but it means something different now, you know? So yeah.
You recently posted on Facebook a quote from Theodore Roosevelt that was on the first page of the book that you're now reading. First off, what's the book?
Oh, the book is Dare to Fly by Martha McSally. And I was at Barnes & Noble. Here's a trick. So I was at Barnes & Noble and I was about to buy the book because it was about a female pilot, one of the first U.S. female pilots to fly the A-10 Warthog, and she's now a U.S. senator, or she became a U.S. senator. But it was like 29 something. And I went to go pay for it, and they're like, oh, it's going to be like 30 something. I'm like, oh my gosh, no. So I took the book back and I went on Amazon and I saw a used copy for like $9.
There you go. Yeah. Sorry, anyway, Barnes and Noble, but that's just business today, buddy.
So I bought the book, and the first page has a quote of Theodore Roosevelt. And when I posted it, everyone's like, oh my gosh, Ray, I love that quote. And I'm like, I've never seen this quote before. It's amazing. And, you know, to me, you know, it was very relatable in my life because, you know, it says that, you know, you got to give credit to the people who try, you know, who try and who try big, you know, who are willing to give it all of the effort and not be afraid to fail, not be embarrassed to fail. And, you know, because, you know, we all have dreams and, you know, we all have, you know, a passion. And, you know, I feel like I've given it my all and I've had my first fail because I've never really had it. Honestly, Aaron, I've never had a real fail in my career. I mean, there hasn't really been a time where I got fired or a time where I, you know, something really bad happened to me. Like I said, everything seemed kind of like a dream. So this was my first real big fail, and it was a giant fail. I mean, it was the ultimate fail. I mean, I went from 100 to zero. So, you know, so that quote, you know, when I read it, I go, man, this is super relatable right now, you know? Yeah. Such a great quote. So that's why I posted it.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. And of course, we'll post this on social media when I talk about the podcast. But I'm right there with you. You know, I prior to my losing my job at KFI in late 2019, I also did not have a fail, you know, and then it was the ultimate fail. And it took me a few months of, you know, again, licking my wounds and trying to figure out what the heck just happened. And it was a blessing. It was a gift because it allowed me to be home to connect with my wife and daughters. Of course, going into the pandemic, I'm needed here more than ever. Mm-hmm. And what turned out with my wife passing in November, you know, to be the last year of her life. And I was here for it and home for it and able to take care of her during that time and take care of my daughters during that time. And you don't know, if we go back to, you know, the idea of cliches, you just don't really know God's timing until it's months or years, decades sometimes later.
Right. It can be frustrating in the process, and extremely frustrating because, like, you don't know why or how long, and you many times feel like, you know, I don't deserve this. You know, why did it happen to me? I'm one of the good people, you know, why me? And, you know, and you always focus on yourself, but, you know, I guess we're not allowed to see the big picture sometimes, but when you do recognize it later on, you know, you are thankful for, you know, being there at home, you know, in that important time. And for me, the same, because I've learned and I've realized, you know, my closest ones could leave this earth at any moment, at any time. And you know what? Maybe I'm here because spend time with people like you, Aaron. Spend time, because right now you might not have this time again when things start to pick up. So do it now. And I think that's an important lesson.
Yeah. Imagine if you had stayed in Dallas for that extra year, and then the pandemic hits just as it did. I mean, your mental health was already taking a toll when you left. Add another year to that, and then add the pandemic on top of that. It's It's all supposed to happen the way it happens, man.
Yeah, and what as you get older, you realize that things become bigger. You know, the confusion gets bigger and problems get bigger. But still, when things begin to make sense, you realize, if you really truly follow your heart, it's hard. It's hard not to look back and say, I at least I followed my heart and I made the right decision because I felt it. You know, on book, you're supposed to do it this way, or, your friends or coworkers tell you to do it this way. But ultimately, it's you, and your heart and God. And, and as we're getting older, we're responsible for our own decisions. And when you look back, it's you don't regret them. You don't regret because you felt like you did the right thing.
That's a great place to end it, Freddie. Thank you so much for the time today. I appreciate it, man.
Aaron, thank you. I appreciate it, man. And by the way, I'm debating on whether I should get an RE27 or the Shure mic, because I don't have a Shure mic yet. And everybody's like, Freddie, you got to get a Shure mic. And I'm like, I know. And the way it sounds here on your podcast, I mean, your settings, it's so good. So
I had a choice between this and the one you're using, the RE20. And I asked three or four people who I trust for their audio opinions. And everybody said that you could go with either and be good. But the Shure SM7B has a little bit, it's a little bit richer. It's a little bit richer. It's not as flat.
Yes.
And that was, for me, that would put it over the edge.
I got to get one of those.
You can watch this episode on YouTube and DBNATV. Follow the Aaron Bender podcast on your favorite platforms and link to it at aaronbender.com. That's also where you can find all my social media. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me, aaronbendermedia@gmail.com. Be well, and thanks for listening.